But first, it's time for our Shapiroette. Bruce, welcome back. You and I have been banging on about Biden calling Putin a war criminal, and I've made the obvious complaint that America could be accused of having double standards because it doesn't actually sign up to the ICC.
Well, yes, what's interesting about this, Philip, is that this very argument is now going on, we've learned, in a heated way within the Biden White House. And indeed, it turns out, within some Republican precincts as well. And to understand the sort of awkward and difficult position the White House is in now, as the news from Mariupol and elsewhere in Ukraine just keeps getting worse and worse. We heard, you know, possible use of chemical weapons in the news just before coming to air. As the news and the likelihood of and the clear evidence of major atrocities grows, the Biden White House is looking specifically at why it is that the U.S. has been so resistant to the International Criminal Court. And to understand that, you have to go back a ways. First, in some ways, to the Vietnam era, when the real accusations of mass atrocities and crimes of war were leveled, first of all, against American troops like Lieutenant William Calley, who was convicted, and never laid against higher-ups, generals, Henry Kissinger, who ordered the bombing of Cambodia, and others, a kind of argument about war crimes in America that goes back to that time, but also really to the run-up to the Gulf War and to the debates of the late 90s, early 2000s. When the International Criminal Court was established, a couple of factions in the U.S., sort of the American military, which was concerned about troops being vulnerable to prosecutions for actions in the field, and isolationist Republicans who didn't like the UN, don't like international institutions generally, put forward some real legislation. There are laws going from 1999 and 2002 that actually prohibit Congress from appropriating money or the administration using U.S. money to support the criminal court, that prevent the U.S. from actually joining the International Criminal Court. And this got a boost in the Iraq War when the Bush administration supported a law that actively protected, was designed to protect American troops from prosecution. And that's really when the funding ban dates to. Now, suddenly, this has changed. And so you've got an argument going on. And interestingly, one of the allies of this seems to be a key Republican, Senator Lindsey Graham, who is pushing his own legislation, urging the investigation into war crimes and perhaps allowing war crimes by international actors to be tried in American courts. But in any event, the issue of accountability clearly is on the table with Russia, but you can't go there without then asking, well, what does the U.S. do?
And let's remember, the U.S. has strenuously objected to an ongoing ICC investigation of alleged Israeli war crimes in Palestine, whilst Donald was incensed by the prospect of an ICC investigation of alleged war crimes in Afghanistan.
Indeed. This has always, it always ends up being American allies or the U.S. who, when they are the target of the ICC, provoke fierce domestic backlash. And you can be sure that if this debate advances and as this legislation advances, there will be pressure, particularly from those concerned with insulating Israel from accountability. There will be concern as well from other factions. And the U.S. military is still taking kind of a long view. I think you'll find a lot of folks in the Pentagon getting queasy at the thought of arming the International Criminal Court with full U.S. support. That said, you know, back in 2010 during the Obama administration, there was an internal memo which said that despite these bans, the U.S. can support the criminal court in investigations of particular individuals, can provide resources and information and investigative backup. And it's quite striking to me. I've learned, for example, that the State Department is and USAID are commissioning ongoing war crimes investigation projects that are going to be deployed in the coming months in Ukraine. It is an interesting inflection point in the long American argument over how to handle atrocities in war and the the extent of Putin's atrocities in Ukraine, in Bucha, in Mariupol, the deliberate targeting of civilians does raise the question of accountability. You have to remember that there are also other ways this can happen. Even as protected a figure as General Pinochet in Chile, who brutalized and tortured his own population, finally did face some justice from the extraterritorial jurisdiction laws in Spain, which allowed his victims to seek justice under Spanish law. And we'll remember the detention of General Pinochet in Europe.
You'll remember Chris Hitchens' campaign to have Kissinger picked up at an international airport as well.
Well, and look, there are some countries where the now elderly Henry Kissinger is not going to go because there are warrants out, okay? One of the things that does happen with these, even when those responsible for large-scale atrocities can't be held to justice, is that they can be constrained, they can be prevented from travel, and in the case of Putin and his allies, I think the likelihood that there will be perhaps lifelong limitations and sanctions on them is a real possibility. But, history is complicated and long, and we don't know how this is going to end up. We do know that the argument that begins with World War II, begins at Nuremberg, and then is revived in the wake of Vietnam, about how to hold governments accountable for mass atrocity and genocide, is now changing before our eyes. And I think that's historic.
Now, Bruce, I'm shocked to learn that the Democrats have had the damn cheek, to appoint someone to the Supreme Court. How the hell did this happen?
Ketanji Brown Jackson confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court last week by 53-47. How did this happen? First of all, she's a remarkable jurist, one of the most highly skilled, thoughtful, and qualified jurists ever to climb up the ladder to the Supreme Court. That was very clear. But secondly, it happened because, first of all, the Democrats did manage to hold their 51-vote majority together. Second, no defections from Joe Manchin or Kristen Sinema. It was solid Democratic support. And secondly, and remarkably given the time, there were three Republicans who did cross the aisle to vote for Judge Jackson to replace Stephen Breyer. Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and Mitt Romney, who interestingly had opposed Judge Jackson when she was nominated to the U.S. Appeals Court. He not only turned around and voted for her, but stood and applauded for her after her confirmation, as most of the rest of the Republican Party quite literally walked out, turned their backs and walked out.
I find it extraordinary that over the years I've warmed to Mitt. He's he's a much better political figure these days than he used to be. Now, but they gave a hell in the confirmation hearings.
Well, they did, and it really was it was a clown car. I mean, the lines of questioning from Republicans to Judge Jackson were cruder and more scurrilous than anything I have seen in my many years of covering U.S. Supreme Court confirmation hearings. You know, there was the allegation, the completely unfounded allegation, that she is soft on pedophiles, which was repeated over and over and over and over again, and seemed to be designed to offer a kind of Venn diagram with QAnon conspiracy obsessions with pedophiles out there in the world. And there was the even more ridiculous moment when Senator Ted Cruz held up a children's book that was designed to advance critical race theory and said, "Do you believe, Judge Jackson, do you believe that all white people are racists?" And there was Judge Jackson, not yet now Justice Designate Jackson, replied, "Senator," and then you could hear the calculation going on in her head. "Senator," pause, and then she decided, rather than lecture him, to say, "No, of course I don't believe that." But there was this attempt to provoke Judge Jackson, but an attempt also to completely caricature the life and career and views of a distinguished, moderate, effective, thoughtful jurist. And, you know, interestingly, when she herself, following her confirmation, got a chance to speak, Justice Designate Jackson was the soul of grace and leaned in an unabashed way into the very identity that Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee and on the floor of the Senate had sought to caricature. She said, "We've made it, all of us," meaning black women, and pointed out that it had taken, on the one hand, 232 years to get a black woman on the Supreme Court, and on the other hand, that in her family, in one generation, her family went from segregation to the U.S. Supreme Court. And she ended up by quoting a memorable line of the always memorable Maya Angelou, "I am the dream and the hope of a slave." And it was, you know, not a dry eye in the House, I think it's fair to say, at a line like that. It speaks again to the complication of the time, that on the one hand, someone like Ketanji Jan Jackson, Brown Jackson, could be confirmed to the Supreme Court with some Republican support, and on the other hand, that Republican opposition to her was not only hard-fought and bitter, but so characterized by cartoons and lies and caricatures and outright crude libels.
Good on you, Bruce. Got to wind it up. Bruce Shapiro, Exec Director of the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia University. And tonight, a rare occasion, some good news from his country.